thank you for having me, guys. My wife's already told me off about the photograph I sent. Excuse me. She said, she don't like that because I'm not looking at the camera. My mate, for those of you who are old enough, my mate said it looks like Rock Hudson and Doris Day. Some people don't know who I'm talking about, don't worry. We've got two sessions this morning, and I have the tendency just to keep talking and talking and talking. So right at the outset, let me say, as I'm talking, please feel free to interrupt me in any way you see fit. If you have a question to ask, if I've assumed knowledge or skated over something, that you could ask me at any time for the next two sessions. In terms of context, I thought it would be good to tell a little bit of how I became a Christian 30 years ago when I was 25 years old. You can do the sums now. And Denise is obviously integral to that story, so she's going to tell some of that alongside me. So, like I said, I was 25 years old. I wasn't brought up in a Christian family. In fact, I don't know any of my family who were Christians at the time I became a Christian. There was no Christian heritage or history that I knew of, and I still haven't found out. As far as I know, I'm the first one in the recent, certainly the recent history of my family who was a Christian. At the time, me and Denise were living together. We had our first child, who was a little baby. I was earning a living as a bricklayer, and I was happy and content with my lot. I've achieved all my life's ambitions because I had a home, a family, and a job. That was my ambitions in life, and that was all good. And then something happened. Well, then what happened was Denise, on one Saturday night in January 1984, said, "I'm going to church in the morning." And I honestly thought she'd gone a bit mad. Really, Jesus, God, church was never part of our vocabulary or conversation. We never talked about this sort of stuff. And for her to say to me, "I'm going to church in the morning," what's gone wrong with her? So probably at this point, it'd be good to introduce her so she could realise she's not that mad after all. But she can tell you some of that story leading up to that point. So is that right, Denise? Do we use this one? Is this on?
Yeah, as Paul said, we weren't Christians, we were living together, we weren't married, and we just had a little baby. And I didn't come from a Christian family at all. I don't know anyone in my family who's been a Christian or is a Christian. And before this night, when I said to Paul, "I'm going to go to church in the morning," about a year before that, I was staying in Streatham with one of my aunts. We was there for the weekend, and somebody was giving that leaflet on the street and gave me a leaflet, and I was too polite to throw it away, so I put it in my bag. And then I'd always had this fear of dying, and my mum was always scared of dying. She never wanted to talk about it. "Oh no, it's scary." And it flashed off on me, and I had the real fear of dying. I wonder what happens to you when you die. And then, because you're young, it goes out of your mind, and it comes back again. And this particular night, we'd not long had our little baby, and I went upstairs to find something, and I was looking, I think it was a nail varnish or something silly, looking for it, and I was looking for an old handbag that I hadn't used for a while, and I thought, "What is this?" And it was this leaflet that had been given to me about a year before. I sat on the bed, and I thought, "Well, what's this about?" Started to read it. Well, all I can say is I went upstairs, I wasn't a Christian, and as I read it, I met Jesus in my bedroom. I became a Christian there and then. As I read it, it made sense. And I thought, "I'm not a Christian." And it was such an old-fashioned leaflet. It was, "Are you upward bound or downward bound?" And the lifestyle I've led, I thought, "I'm downward bound." And I thought, "But I prayed the prayer up there, and no one told me how to do it or anything. This leaflet just made sense to me." So I came downstairs, and Paul said, "I even looked different. My eyes looked different." And I said, "Paul, I'm going to go to church tomorrow." And he really honestly thought I'd gone mad. Well, I did go to church, and I went in, and the only church I knew was when I was a little girl. A friend of mine used to go to Sunday school to one of these churches, and it was a bit more fashion in this. I was saying earlier, it had all burgundy velvet around, and
it was local FIEC.
So, and I remember going there as a little girl to Sunday school with her, and everyone was so friendly there. But because my family didn't go to church, there was no one to take me every week, so it kind of fizzled out. But I never forgot it, and so I thought, I'm going to go there. So I thought it started at 11:30, but it started at 10:30. So at 11:30, it had sliding doors. I went in on my own, slid the door back, and it was full of mostly old people, and everybody looked round.
Because we are there now, aren't we?
We are there now. And I tiptoed in, and I didn't want anybody to look at me, because all I wanted to do was cry, because I suppose it was just, I'd met with Jesus, and everything in me wanted to just cry, but I thought, I'm going to embarrass myself. So I found a little spot, sat down, and I just held it in. I suppose it was like being convicted of my sin. I wanted to just cry out loud, but I didn't. I held it in, and afterwards, somebody came up to me and said, my maiden name then was Denise Lovell. Are you Denise Lovell? And I said, yeah. And he said, what are you doing here today? I said, I don't really know. And I explained, I found this leaflet and I've come along that day. And he said, he used to do like the youth work there. And he had a register of names and my name was on that. And he said, when I go running in the mornings, he said, I've been praying for you for years. And I just thought, I'm so grateful to that man. He might never have seen me again, but he was faithful and prayed. He's a school teacher and he just loved kids. And he prayed, and I believe it's God used him, that somebody gave me that leaflet, that I ended up becoming a Christian. And you just think, it's just amazing, isn't it, how God works in your life. So, but then anyway, the fear of death went, I never felt scared again. And and then I'll hand back to Paul now, and he can take over. Okay.
So then she started on me. why don't you come to this church? Why don't you come and meet these people? Why do I want them? I was happy, I was content, I'd achieved my life's ambitions, life was good. She was even happier, which made me even happier. And she said, you must come and meet these people, you've got blah, blah, blah. And she'd try all sorts of tactics. And one time she said to me, I don't want you to go to hell. And I thought, I don't want me to go to hell either. Not that I knew, it just doesn't sound nice, does it? You don't choose that. And so eventually I went along to this church, and I'd love to say God impacted me like he did with Denise, but he didn't. I thought this, all this singing and stuff, it was just the weirdest thing, right? And I thought, I ain't going back there again, isn't it? And as I was going to leave that, my first experience ever of church as a 25-year-old, one of the fellas there, an older guy, a big Welsh bricklayer, found out I was also a bricklayer. He gave me a guided tour of the brand new church building that he'd essentially built single-handedly in the car park of this old mission hall, which was basically corrugated tin, wired and rendered just to make it look like a proper building. And he built this grand brick-built venue, and he gave me a guided tour of his handiwork, and then he said to me, I'm preaching next week, will you come again? Because I'm so soft-hearted, I said, yeah, well, then I'll come again. So I came back the following week, and as I'd like to say to you then, I saw Jesus in the flesh, and I responded to him, but I didn't. It was still weird. In fact, it was even weirder, because this big Welsh bricklayer got up to preach from the book of Jonah. I still remember it all those years ago. And he started weeping. And that didn't impress me. I just thought, what is up with that man? But you can see the hand of God in it, because I wasn't impressed. I didn't really like it. I was uncomfortable. It was culturally so weird for me. But what hooked me was the people. And there was something about these Christians which I couldn't put my finger on. I had a huge circle of friends. Most of them were in the building trade. And none of them were like this lot. And it was enough. It was like a hook catching a fish. And it was enough for me to say, I don't know anything about Jesus, so I'm going to find out. And then at that point, I started reading bits of the Bible, and I started reading books that people suggested, and I had all the difficult questions. I thought, I'll catch you on this one. And the more I got my answers, and the more I read, and the more I thought, and the more I encountered Jesus, the more I thought, this stuff makes sense. This stuff is real. And it got to a point where I was alone, in bed, in the dark, and I went red with embarrassment because I knew I was going to pray for the first time in my life. And I prayed. I was just, no one with me, I just said, Jesus, please forgive me for the things I've done wrong. And I said, and I remember saying, I'm going to follow you for the rest of my life. And I've never, ever looked back. 30 years ago, lots of things have happened, and lots of difficult things have happened through our life, as well as great things. And but you think, whatever, however tough or however difficult those things are, I'm looking for them with Jesus now. You know, it's wonderful, isn't it? We've moved around, we helped to plant a church in on the Thames Estuary in Gravesend, and then we moved from there up to Bermondsey in central London, where we are now, and I'll make some reference to that in a little while, to be part of an existing church, a church I'm part of now. It's called City Hope Church. It's part of the New Frontiers family of churches, but it was originally Drummond Road Baptist Church. Spurgeon put his own, some of his own money into building our building in the 1860s. And I've been on the staff of that church for 20 years. I know. And some of what I'm going to talk about is based really on my experiences, particularly in my current church, and because the area I moved to was very much a traditional white working class area, Bermondsey around the Surrey Docks. If you don't know your geography, essentially the Old Kent Road is the southern boundary, the River Thames is the northern boundary. Tower Bridge going, drifting towards London Bridge is the western boundary, if that gives you a sort of, get your Google Maps out, have a coffee if you're interested. and over the 20 years I've been there, rapidly that area has changed. Massive gentrification over the last 10 years, loads of middle class incomers, which has pushed up the property prices to an unbelievable level. Lots of West African incomers, there's a fair number of Eastern Europeans, and the spattering of loads of other nationalities. So it's a real mix up where we are now, from being not that long ago almost exclusively white and working class. Loads of positives with that, a certain number of negatives as well, maybe they'll come out as well. And a lot of what I'm going to say is really based on a sabbatical that I was given 3 years ago or so now, a 3 month sabbatical. And what I did, I looked to spend a bit of time studying that whole phenomenon, if you like, the relationship between the evangelical church and the working class, particularly the white working class, although I understand that title can stretch across the sort of racial spectrum. What I'm going to talk about is a very personal thing, in terms of, you know, other people can give different definitions and different insights, but you haven't got anyone else here, so you're going to get mine. like I said, 3 months, I interviewed a number of people, I read quite a lot of books, I chatted to people, Christians and non-Christians and church leaders and lay people. I spoke to union leaders and barristers and armed robbers and all sorts of people to get just a bit of insight and understanding. But what kicked it off for me, or what sort of turned the switch for me, coming from a working class background, I just drifted into church life, predominantly white middle class church life. Loved it. Listen, this is not... please don't think Paul Bragg's up without any class or background or culture. I think we should celebrate who we are in Christ and wherever we're from. He's given us our background, he's given us our testimony. He's ordained the exact times and places where we should live, isn't he? Yeah. So I'm not... If you think, oh, Paul's having a go at me, or he's having a go at someone else, I'm not. I might be a bit throw out some provocative statements, but I'm going to be nice, honest. To acknowledge the sort of multicultural in our particular church, we put on some, and that phrase has come out of fashion a little bit now, multicultural, isn't it? Diversity we try and use now. But we put on a series of what we then called multicultural evenings. And, well, on one of those evenings, we sat in small groups and we compared the experiences of life. We talked about family holidays, our school days, meal times, just ordinary things of life like that. And in my group, there was a real mix of people. I remember there was a Filipino lady, there was a Cameroonian lady, an Iraqi man, there was a Nigerian couple, there was a white working class lady whose roots were in central London, and there was me. And as we talked and as people shared their experiences, the biggest difference of experience expressed in that group was nothing to do with nationality, but everything to do with class. So the Cameroonian lady, she spoke of her school days. She said, when the driver used to pick me up every morning and drive me to school. Right now, if you look at her in London, she lives in a small council flat, and her husband is a bus driver, right? But her experience in Cameroon was her parents, one was an engineer and one was an architect, right? So she was driven to school, she did finishing school in Paris, right? And part, I suppose, that's why she's got the resources to end up in London, but living a much more modest life in a different city. So I was wrestling with this, and I thought, this is about class, and it challenged me. And as, like I said, I had the opportunity to have 3 months off just to look at that issue, because it became apparent that the church generally is not effectively reaching the working class in this country. And I guess that's why we're here today, because typically, now there is lots of pockets of exception, and I think, incidentally, our church is an exception, which is by the grace of God why maybe I've been invited to do this, for a number of reasons. Spurgeon planted that church into what was then a very, very working class area. And our building was on a street of what was then houses. Victorian terraced houses now, there's 1960s blocks that are all around our building. And consequently, it's in our DNA, if you like, as a church, our makeup as a church, that we're there to reach the working class. On our leadership, there's myself, obviously, as a bricklayer, one of my fellow full-time leaders was 30 years a postman in the area before he came full-time. So there's a real mix on our leadership, which I think qualifies me a little bit to talk about this subject. I'm going to read a few quotes of things that really challenged me. One by a lady called Gillian Evans, who wrote a book called Education Failure Amongst White Working Class Children in Britain Today, something like that, snappy title, right? and her study was based around the area I live in, so it was a bit more interesting. She said this: to be valued in Britain at the beginning of the 21st century, a person has to be either middle class or ethnic, and with no viable way to participate publicly themselves, this leaves white working class people feeling that rather than being valued as the primary movers against unfair hierarchies, they have become, ironically, a block to equality. Meanwhile, when made synonymous with the so-called underclass or non-working class, the white working class way of life is increasingly portrayed as a cultural disgrace. Quite strong words, but I don't think they're wrong words. And you only have to read certain newspapers that just underline that. And television programmes, even recently, that underline that statement about being a cultural disgrace. Also, as I was reading, I discovered that, surprise, surprise, this issue of the church and the working class is not a new one. So Anglican minister Roger Lloyd, in a slim volume he wrote back in the 50s, said this. He said, the artisan class constitutes by far the toughest identifiable core of resistance to the gospel today. Up to the present, no dents at all have been made in its surface. It is a hard saying, but a true one, that until some more effective way of appealing to the artisan has been found, there will be no real revival of religion in this country. No amount of success elsewhere will compensate the church for failure here. Again, provocative, strong words, but it's so true, looking back from the 50s onwards. And bring it a bit closer to date, in the 70s, the good doctor, Martin Lloyd-Jones, said this: the impression has gained currency that to be a Christian, and more especially an evangelical, means that we are traditionalists. I believe that this largely accounts for our failure in this country to make contact with the so-called working classes. Christianity in this country has become a middle-class movement. Far too often, as non-conformist men have got on in the world and made money and become managers and owners, they have become opponents of the working classes who were agitating for their rights. So he's observed something similar in the 70s, and even right up to date, the gulf between the evangelical church and the working classes is as huge as ever. And presumably that's why St. Helen's Bishopsgate, a few years ago, put on a conference entitled Reaching the Unreached, not referring to some remote, obscure people group on the other side of the world, but the urban working classes in Britain today. So it's something that's been hanging around the evangelical church for decades, and we're still wrestling with it today. No one lights a lamp and lights it under a bowl. We hold to the truth of that, don't we? How stupid would that be? But the truth is, when it comes to establishing churches among working class communities, it seems easy to grab the bowl and hide the light. It's easier to do that than break into some of the communities that are around us. I visited Coventry, which is an interesting town to visit because the industry that made that town thrive, that city thrive, was pretty much gone. And by and large, that's the motor industry. And Coventry has got loads of great churches in the centre of town. Most of the denominations are there, and they're working hard, and they've got some shiny new buildings. But round the sort of outskirts of the town, particularly to the north and east, there are whole swathes of estates which were built, housing, social housing, to serve the workers for the car industry and a couple of other industries that are there, which have also gone. Small textiles, significant textiles industries that have gone now. And those people don't come into the town centre for lots of reasons on a Sunday. So what we do is, to the south or west of the town, is the middle class communities that who are much more mobile, they would typically travel more, and so the churches are thronged with middle class communities. God bless them. We want to see the whole world in that. We want to see people say. But when I went and drove around the estates to the north and east of Coventry, I saw redundant church buildings. I saw a big Methodist community mission boarded up. I saw an Anglican church building designed by the same architect that did the Coventry Cathedral, slightly more modest, but the same architect. I thought it was derelict. Apparently, it's still open. It just didn't look derelict. It was all overgrown. Apparently, there's still a handful of people still worshipping there, not impacting their communities. Why are you hiding your light? You know, don't put that light under a basket. It's difficult, isn't it?
Sorry to break into your...
No, that's what I said at the beginning, didn't I?
Okay. Could I just ask you, Paul, to maybe define for us who you're calling the working class?
That is the thorny question, and I expected it to come sooner or later. Do you know, I've read loads and loads of books, and no one can quite define it with hard edges. And it's even more difficult now, because we don't have a manufacturing base or an industry base in this country. So, I'm going to struggle to define it in a few sentences, but what I would say is, and I'm going to look at some values in a moment, and I think the class now is as much value-based as anything else. So it's certainly not income-based, although I think the predominantly poorer people would be classed as working class. But there's plenty of richer, affluent people who serve. My brother, for example, has just sold a five-bedroom, three-bathroom house in Bexley in Kent with parking for, I don't know how many cars on the front, you've got to get 8 cars on the front of this, can't you? And he is not a middle class man, but he's a very affluent working class man. Right? So, and I'm going to look at values that people hold dear, which I think would define someone slightly more as working class than middle class. Now, even that is probably open to debate. But as we go through this, I think I will answer some of your question. I don't want to sell you short. So please, if you think that you've just fudged that, could you put your hand up in a little while? Is that okay? Because I'm going to look at some issues as I discover. That's a distinctive. If we think in a certain way, we're going to miss it, or we say the same thing but mean something totally different. So. Is that okay? Right. So I talked about my experience when I visited Coventry and hiding our light under a basket, under a bushel. Guy Hankey, well, who some of you may read, is a Christian blogger. He said Christians are afraid that engaging the outside world would inevitably result in persecution. They'll damage our stuff, he says. Or pollution. Their sin will lead our young people astray. Consequently, the doors remain shut, the saints remain comfortable, and the lost remain hellbound. Very provocative. This same fear is arguably the main reason that while there is an abundance of hip churches being planted in safe areas appealing to students and the upwardly mobile 1830s, church plants behind enemy lines in the ghettos and sink estates, he says, of the UK are a rare phenomenon. And again, particularly in London, London's like the Bible Belt now, I don't know what it's like down there. There's loads of churches for shiny, happy people, you know, the people who move to London, they've got their career going, and they're eating in the right restaurants, and they live in the right places. Churches are thriving. But there's whole swathes of central London, and I'm sure areas around you, who are not even impacted by the gospel, like I described in Coventry. Gillian Evans talks about mutual disdain between the classes. She said the relationship between the social classes in England hinges on a segregation that is emotionally structured through mutual disdain. In other words, the differences between people of distinct classes are deeply felt and not just occupationally defined, which I've referred to really. Overcoming them is not, therefore, going to be a simple intellectual decision or even the inevitable outcome of the change in economic futures, fortunes, or political will. It's going to be a question of how far we can overcome the embodied and largely unconscious history of how we've come to value ourselves. This is the sort of thing where you'll go to Bible college to learn the culture of a far-off people group, because it can be so different. And that disdain is all around us. And I think recent television programs, Benefit Street, which I have not watched because I probably would have kicked my telly and I'm quite right. Things that have a certain flavour and certain bent in how they communicate, even in comedy. So, again, Gillian Evans refers to in her book, she says it's easy and fashionable in TV programs like Little Britain to satirise and caricature the white working classes in Britain, but people don't really like to talk seriously about class, particularly the white working class. And this attitude is often found in the church. So people are casually ridiculed and written off as chaffs, right? Maybe you've heard that phrase. I don't like it. But I've heard Christians use that quite freely. And in a way that they would never dream of talking about any other subculture or people group. I've sat around dinner tables with lovely, mature Christian church leaders and their families, and they've openly and comfortably talked about not liking certain parts of their town and not going there because of the chavs. Now, what's the implications of that? If a church leader and his family are saying, well, we don't go to that part of town, then that part of town's not going to get reached by the gospel, is it? It's a challenge. you know, in some of the bookshops, you get, as you go to the checkout, you get those little tiny books to tempt you to spend even more money. There's one book there called The Little Book of Chavs. And it says chavs are imbeciles who do jobs like hairdressing and cleaning and bar work and being a security guard, and they live on pot noodles, cheap cider and McDonald's for Sunday lunch. Right? Now, see, these things are done humorously, but underlying it is an attitude which will form a huge barrier between people who take the high ground and say, well, my way is better. Now, it may well be in lots of areas, but I would say not in every area. My way is better. My culture is more superior to theirs, so I'm going to put them down. And generally, them don't have the financial or political clout to come back. So Johann Hari, is it Harry or Hari, the journalist, he was writing The Independent a couple of years ago. He said, one of the things about chavs that seems to anger middle-class people is their loudness and lack of taste. Why are chavs so in your face? Why can't they just shut up, asked one website. They want their poor people, this is Harry talking again, they want their poor people to be passive and silent and unseen. They want them to be a kind of training middle class, humbly saving up to buy the same labels as decent middle England folk. If they develop a value system of their own, or if they dare to intrude into middle class space in any way, then they must be put in their place with this degrading and cruel label. Not very far from the surface of talk about chavs is the idea that the poor are culturally, or even in some way genetically, deserving of their circumstance. It's provocative, isn't it? But it's challenging. It makes you think, oh, we're having like that here. I don't know if it, do you remember Jade Goody? Somebody remember Jade Goody on TV? Yeah. She's from Bermondsey. Used to see her around sometimes, see her mum and her nan and her granddad. People had an attitude to her. She provoked a lot of emotional response. And this was one particular blogger, a very extreme response, but nonetheless, I think a little representative in content, if not in language. This blogger said, I think that Jade and her mother and her entire family, of whom we have been the unfortunate viewers of, are a bunch of uneducated, criminally ignorant lavatory scum. I hope that the Goody clan end up back in the depths of their own filth and obscurity where they belong. She got a completely undeserved infamy by pimping herself on telly, and now she thinks she's a top-class celebrity. Well, she's just a bleak, bleak chav of the lowest order. Now, if it comes, that's strong, isn't it? We're talking about a person, in fact, well, she died of cancer a few years ago, didn't she? Mm-hmm. We're talking about a human being there who's a daughter and a parent and all the rest of it. That, although that is extreme, it's not entirely unrepresentative. There are very polite, watered-down versions of that all around us, and even in the church. So, through my bit of research those few years ago, I went to one church and I spoke to a working-class man. He was a builder, painter and decorator, who had become a Christian through this particular church's CAP ministry, Christians Against Poverty. Fantastic ministry. If you don't run a CAP centre, investigate the possibility, because I think it's great. This person, he described going into church for the first time, and he said, no one spoke to me. No one in this middle class church spoke to him for ages after he became a Christian. He said, but I forgave him. Yeah, I've got an attitude, don't I? And people won't be malicious or nasty, because I know what it's like. It's difficult. You don't know what to talk about. You don't know where to connect. So you don't. Maybe, I don't know if, I've experienced this, when I used to work on building sites, some of the guys from the west coast of Ireland would speak the same language as me, and I think, oh, you just will be speaking Russian, because I don't understand what you're saying. And the temptation is, well, I'm not going to speak to him then. Or if you've ever tried to communicate with someone who is deaf, it can be difficult and slightly embarrassing. So sometimes the easiest thing is not to do it. Now, and I think sometimes people do the same thing with, I don't know how to speak to this person, I don't know. My life experience doesn't match theirs in any way, so I'm not going to talk to them. We've got to cross those barriers with the gospel. We've got to cross those barriers and be prepared to be embarrassed and make mistakes if we want to see people saved. spoke to a church leader once who proudly showed me his luxury new bathroom in his house. This is a friend of mine. And then over dinner, complained about the huge TV someone had put in their tiny council flat. Well, he's just showed me thousands of pounds of a luxury bathroom compared to a couple of £100 of television. But to him, this was a good thing and that was a bad thing. Who makes that decision? You know? A number of church leaders, when I asked about how they were reaching the working classes, as I sort of went up and down the country chatting to people, would highlight their ministry to the poor. That's how they would respond. I said, how are you reaching the working class? And, you know, their mercy ministries, if you like. They're feeding the homeless and helping the pregnant teenagers and generally serving the unfortunate. That wasn't what I asked, interestingly. That's how people translated that question. They weren't really aware of the working classes, or more importantly, if there'd been a cultural difference between the classes. And I think that's where this whole couple of hours is going, is being aware of cultural differences. And if we're not careful, those mercy ministries, and believe it, as a church, we've recently started a food bank. I have views about that, but I think, well, I'll tell you what the views are. I think the trust, I think, are doing a fantastic job. It disappointed me to read that they would like to see a food bank in every town in this nation. I think their goal should be no food banks anywhere in this nation. But it's an emergency response, mostly to government decisions. Don't get me going about that either. Right?
All I'm hearing so far.
Yeah, I will get nicer than
that. All I'm hearing so far is middle class against working class. I'm actually from a working class background. And when I came into our local evangelical church,
yes,
I threw out the barrier straight away because I saw the church as either middle class or upper class. And I struggled, and I've been struggling for about 2.5 years, yes, since I've been down here. And it's because I see, whether or not it's right or not, I see with disdain, these people seem totally alien to what I've been used to. And you're putting it all on middle class down to working class, but it works
both ways. That's really perceptive, but my main reason for doing it this way, and it is deliberate, is because typically middle class is the dominant culture. And that's true in the church, and we're going to look at how leadership is structured if we get that far. And naturally, nationally, middle class culture is the dominant culture. So it's interesting. So my kids went to a store with lots of black kids, mostly black African, and there's lots of casual racism amongst school children, whether you like it or not. It happens, right? There's comments going both ways. My white kids were not offended or insulted by racist comments coming from the black kids. They laughed them off. And the reason for that is because they are the dominant culture. As white people in the UK, we are the dominant culture, even if you're in a minority in a certain setting. And I think there's a weight that comes one way to the other. So I am being a little bit weighted in this. But let me say this, and I think I did say it at the beginning. Enjoy who you are in your background. Revel in your character and personality. We want to be like Jesus, right? But because your parents were both Oxbridge educated and have come from old money and you've done really well, I don't know if anyone's like that in here, but I'm trying to paint an extreme picture. That's not wrong. It's not wrong. There'll always be poor amongst us, for example, but what I'm trying to do is just say, look, let's be aware of massive cultural differences in white working class people. And really, I'm still on your preamble, although I'm 3/4 of the way in of this first session, right? But I would agree we all, as working class people, we have prejudices and we have background which shape us and makes us get defensive when we don't want to be. So it does work both ways, but I am weighting it from a certain viewpoint, which is why I said at the beginning, don't feel you're not having a go at anyone. There's a style of what I'm doing. Is that alright?
Don't shoot me when I...
Yeah, so did you want to say something?
No, okay. Agree with you.
Thank you. That's what I like to hear. It's always good when you read a book and they, you think, oh, that's good, isn't it? So you say it's good because they agree with what you think. So I was talking about the mercy ministries, and we, like I say, as a church, we run those, but we have to be careful that we don't become patronising and condescending with those ministries, because we can easily rob people of their dignity, and that's why at Food Bank, I think we have to work really hard as when people come. So if you lot go somewhere because you haven't even got the money to buy food, man, that is so demeaning, isn't it? And I think that's good. If we're running food banks, and I know there's at least one or two in here, we have to be very careful in how we do that. But more importantly, those marginalised groups are not representative of the working class. And like I said earlier, I don't know how quite to define it, but I'm going to attempt to in a little while. There are millions of people in this country who don't need or want that kind of support, the CAP and the food bank type of support, but they do need Jesus. And they're not going to walk through our doors to get a handout of food. Somebody put it to me like this, somebody who actually worked with black people in the townships of South Africa and really drew the parallel of black South Africans with the white working class in this country. And she said, the working classes are more human. They live amongst the nuts and bolts of humanity. They face life full on. The middle class church needs to learn humanity from the working classes. Mm-hmm. And she's translated that from her experience of the black community in Cape Town, coming into a white, predominantly white middle class church, and all the back machine forms went through. So we as churches, I think, this may be, please don't think he's having a go at me, we need to overcome some self-satisfied feelings of superiority. And that may be really deep within us and not something we've chosen to be, we just are. And I'll say we, I'll still say I'm working class. Lots of my family say I'm posh and middle class, because I've taken on certain values, Christian values, attitudes to money, attitudes to family. I've tried to dissect what is a middle class value and what is a church Christian value, because so often they're so intertwined that you can't tell which is which. Maybe we'll look at some of that in a minute if I say the right things. So what would churches have to do to overcome those self-satisfied feelings of superiority? First, I think we need to engage with those people, them chavs, and I don't like that phrase. Learn their language, find out about their closely held values, discover and learn and understand what they hold dear, and if it lines up with Christian values, then we need to adopt them. And I'm going to talk about community and family and relationship and stuff like that in a little while. But we need to value them as people, not projects. And I think if you take anything away from this morning, to value them as people and not projects is one of the most important things I'd like to say. And if we see people as people, then that will be a foundation for everything else we do. I believe we need to completely change our mindset in the church so that we can allow all people to enrich us as individuals and as churches. And I've observed it so many times in just little conversations and little settings where actually if somebody has got a good formal education and if they've got a good income level and that they are listened to more than somebody who's left school at 15 or 16 and is struggling now with low paying work. And that is not necessarily the case. Everyone's got something to contribute to the family of God, haven't they? Mm-hmm. We really need to believe that. Mm-hmm. And in my conclusion, I'm going to highlight some heroes of faith who maybe in your churches would not have got a look in because of their lack of formal education in their background. In the last couple of years, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation has commissioned some work exploring what it means to be white and working class in Britain today. Now, if you haven't looked at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation stuff, have a look. They've done some great research and some very in-depth research, which you can draw on. There's papers and stuff out there for free. It's nice when it's for free, isn't it? So you can download quite long PDF documents from there. But it's really, really helpful. Some of the key points in some of their papers, which I sort of pulled out, just looking at white working class communities, is the recent and profound economic and social change that this country's experienced. There's increased isolation and fear in traditional white states and communities. Residents, it's interesting, they research, come out of their research, right and up and down the country, this wasn't confined to one particular city, residents often claimed that things were better in the past. Now, I know we do that. And we, well, I certainly do. I mean, it's like, it's wow, it was better back then, wasn't it? But I think if you were in a community that was built around a single industry, like in a mining village or a still working town, and that industry's gone, then things were certainly better back then. Because back then, your men could earn, you know, it was men, wasn't it? The men could earn a good wage for a hard day's work. There was money in the community, and that meant that it was a thriving community. There was closeness because pretty much everyone worked in that single industry or related industries. It's very close knit. There was a strength of community. That's what we say about church as well, isn't it? We're a community. There's strength in that. And then when that industry is taken away, sometimes through government decision and sometimes just through the way things go, then no wonder people say it's better back then. Virtually all the people interviewed by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation refer to social change of one kind or another, and that takes both economic and cultural forms. So they talk about people's sense of identity in so many communities clearly defined by the history of industrialisation in that area. So in Bermondsey, the Surrey docks were massive. And that affected pretty much every family in life. The docks, that's where people found, so many thousands found their identity. So I watched a very interesting and poignant documentary about the Surrey docks. But when they finally closed the docks in the 70s, of people taking their own life just because that part of their identity was ripped away from them. Now, people from that side of the field, that's a hard, dirty, dangerous job. Who wants to do that? But when you've grown up amongst it, and your family and your uncles and your brothers have been working there, and it's part of who you are, that loss of manufacturing work, that doesn't only have a profound economic impact, but it threatens your very sense of identity. This is who I am. And when that's ripped away, it's going to have a big social impact on the place, isn't it? It's just to be aware of these things. As we look at people, we don't judge and we try and value people. So the loss of jobs has not only been damaging economically, but also culturally. That report also highlights the shift from manufacturing to service industry and that impact on employment. So when a man in a coal mining town could go and earn good money, and now the only full-time job he can get is in a call centre. Incidentally, there are more people working in call centres in the UK than there ever was at the height of the mining. So there's more call centre workers than miners at the height of the mining. What sort of job is that? Now, the argument is, well, it's a job, it's better than nothing. Man alive. Can you build a community around a call centre? I don't think you can. You can build a community around a church, though. It highlights the massive reduction in social housing stock. I live in a council house. It's a complicated system. I left the council house to move up to a church house where the church is the tenant of a council house. Very complicated, part of a compulsory purchase deal done years ago. But the people's attitude to social housing, even in the last 15 years, has changed totally. I mean, there's even a bit in the paper about, they do it every year, the time that the railway workers go on strike. So Bob Crowe, who is the head of a national trade union, earns about $140,000 a year, lives in a council house. And it's like shock horror. He lives in a council house. He should move out of that house and let a poor family move in. Social housing was never intended as just for the poorest level of society. In fact, social housing, before Margaret Thatcher started to sell them off, people from all walks of life were in council houses and council flats. In fact, when I moved to our church 20 years ago, there was two doctors who were still in council flats. Because that was the history. It was to keep communities mixed and together, and there was something about it. And it just on the Bob Crowe thing, wouldn't it be interesting if he said, okay, I'll buy my council house? What? That's not going to give it to, it's not going to give it to anyone on the housing list, anything. Anyway, that's just an aside. But massive reduction of social housing stock has been highlighted as one of the big problems, the enormous increase in housing prices, increasing inequalities in wealth and pensions, the social class system simultaneously disadvantages the working class while giving advantage to other classes. That's the conclusion of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. So it says, the social class system simultaneously disadvantages the working class while giving advantage to the other classes. I still haven't defined class very at all, really, but I think it's bang on 11. That is actually, in my notes, I put a line there and said, this is a good place for a possible break, so I've been perfect in my talking. should we finish there, unless there's any questions we want to conclude this session with. Let me just tell you where we're going next time, just in case. So I'm going to look at some different aspects of life which we could make misunderstanding. So attitudes to education, communication, or the way we communicate with one another, attitudes to authority, and I'm forgetting my own notes, I'm turning the page, solidarity as a community, let me look at some of the others, loyalty, a sense of place, money and generosity. I'm going to look at all these things as areas of life which we all face, but we can easily misunderstand one another depending on what side of the social divide we are. I'm going to look at aspects of our meetings and the way we go forward in terms of leadership. Anyway.